the front porch the demons of the American diet.
Too much food and too much of the wrong things. That is the enormous amount of sugar and the white flour and the hydrogenated fats. Those three things are culprits.
This is The Front Porch on NHPR. I'm John Walters. For more than 40 years, Beatrice Trum Hunter has been writing about food and nutrition. Before there was Diet for a Small Planet or the Moosewood cookbooks, and long before supermarkets carried organic foods, Beatrice was an advocate of natural food and healthy living. She's written over 20 books, including The Natural Foods Cookbook, Gardening Without Poisons, and The Great Nutrition Robbery. Beatrice lives in Deering, New Hampshire. She's still writing and speaking on food issues, and in recent years she's become a photographer, taking pictures of ice crystals. That may be the influence of her mother-in-law, the late photographer Lotta Jacoby. Beatrice's work has been showcased in some of the state's leading galleries. Beatrice Trum Hunter joins us to talk about her life and work. Beatrice, welcome to The Front Porch.
Good to be here.
Your first book, The Natural Foods Cookbook, came out in 1961. Was anyone else writing about natural foods at the time?
There were some people, but this, I think, was the first definitive book on natural foods.
Was there any resistance? I mean, did you have trouble finding a publisher or readers?
I had no problem finding publisher or readers, but there was still opposition from some of the people in the nutritional field who were not yet aware of the value of whole foods.
Were you considered a crank at the time?
Not only a crank, but a crackpot. But that's one of the problems when you're before the wave.
What were some of the things that seemed outlandish at the time?
To the nutritionists or the dietitians, the fact that I wasn't using processed foods because they were pushing many of the processed foods.
Well, give me an example of some things that were in common use at the time and probably still are today that you think are bad.
Well, any of the highly processed foods with a very long list of not only ingredients but the additives. And those, of course, include many of the bakery products, soups, instant meals, just add water and mix.
And you're also not a fan of things like white flour and processed sugar and things like that?
True. Mm-hmm. It's better to go back to the basic foods.
Now, your definition of healthy eating is different from some others. You're fine with things like meat, eggs, and butter.
Very much so. Uh-huh. To stay with the foods that have supported human life for many, many generations.
Your first book, Natural Foods Cookbook, includes a recipe for brain salad.
Yes, I did emphasize the organ meats because they were so ignored by many of the other cookbooks at the time. However, I think in the light of what has happened in the meantime, I would certainly eliminate many of the organ meats.
You're not concerned about fat and cholesterol?
Not at all, if it's good fat. Mm-hmm. There are some fats that should be eliminated from the diet, any of the trans fatty acids that are formed when fat or oil is chemically altered through hydrogenation. So margarines would be out.
So margarine's actually worse than butter in your mind?
Absolutely. Butter is good if it's used in a limited quantity. Also, the polyunsaturated fats, such as the soy oil and some of the sunflower, these should be used in very limited quantity.
Now, some of those are generally considered to be healthy.
Well, but they are not as healthy as some of the other oils. The fish oils, linseed oil, are much better. Olive oil is much better.
And I guess you're also not a big fan of tofu.
I'm not a big fan of soy, which is being pushed enormously. It's difficult to find anything in the supermarkets these days without some fraction of soy in the product. And it's overrated, and it's certainly overused.
What's wrong with soy?
It can have a lot of different effects on the body, especially the endocrine system, so that anybody who has a problem with thyroid can run into problems eating a lot of soy products. And it should not be used unless it's in a fermented form. And the only fermented form really is tempeh, tofu is not truly fermented.
What difference does fermenting make in how soy is used in the body?
Much more digestible. And some of the negative features are not maybe eliminated, but certainly lessened. There are a number of anti-nutrients that are in soy, and the fermentation process lessens them.
How did you get so interested in food issues?
I read a book in 1933 that blew my mind. It was 100 Million Guinea Pigs by Callot and Schlink. These were the two owners of Consumers Research Magazine. And the population at that time was 100 million people. So 100 million guinea pigs meant that the population was not being protected. And it was the story of what was happening to foods, drugs, and cosmetics. And as a result of that book, I stopped eating sugar. And for a while, I even gave up apples because the story was told of the spraying of the arsenic in the apple orchards. This, of course, is the period before DDT.
And this was back at a time when there wasn't much government regulation of food additives, chemicals, or cosmetics.
That's right. The laws were on the books, but they were not really being followed very strongly.
Have things gotten better since then?
They've gotten better in some ways. In other ways, they've gotten worse because there's more in the marketplace of the junk food. If you look at what people put in their baskets in the supermarket, you realize that there's an awful lot of junk out there. On the other hand, there's a lot more good food that is available, much more fresh fruits and vegetables, more organically raised fruits and vegetables and meats and eggs and fish and so forth.
I'm John Welters on the front porch on NHPR with Beatrice Trum Hunter. She's a writer, lecturer, food expert, and photographer from Deering, New Hampshire. How have people's attitudes toward food changed over the years?
A good deal. I think many more people are selecting foods that are nourishing. Many more people are looking for certified organic food. That movement has grown fantastically. I didn't think I'd ever live to see whole supermarkets of natural foods and organic foods.
And yet we keep getting heavier.
We keep getting heavier. For one thing, portions are so large. Another thing is that the official advice that has been given to us by the federal government has been very faulty. If you look at the nutritional pyramid, the base of it is the carbohydrates, the bakery products. And there's no distinction made between whole grains and the white flour products. And yet people are being told to eat up to 12 portions a day from this group, which of course has made the baking industry very happy. But it's also put on a lot of poundage.
Are you a fan of the Atkins diet?
I'm not a fan of it, but I think it's going in the right direction, getting back to basic foods and cutting down on the bad carbohydrates. There certainly are good carbohydrates. I think that the Atkins diet is very poor in terms of some of the recommendations. For example, no fruit in the diet, I think, is a faulty recommendation in terms of what we know today about the antioxidants in the and other substances that are found in fruits.
What concerns you the most about the American diet today?
Too much food and and too much of the wrong things. That is the enormous amount of sugar and the white flour and the hydrogenated fats. Those three things are culprits.
A lot of people in the natural food movement are very much opposed to genetically modified foods, and that's something that's growing very rapidly. What do you think of that?
It's another very complex issue. I think that the science behind it is not as well on solid ground as we have been told, and we certainly get some indications now and then that it raises alarms.
Do you buy local whenever you can?
I do, except that local in New England, would not support life over the year because we have such a limited supply locally. I do support the community gardening project, and I try to eat as much not only local but also organically raised food as I can possibly get. But if we just depend on local produce, it's a very limited diet.
You've been concerned for a long time, not only with chemicals and additives in food, but also chemicals in the environment. You wrote a book about gardening without poisons,
yes,
for one thing. And I understand you got to know Rachel Carson, the naturalist, before she wrote Silent Spring. Is it true you actually helped her with that book?
Yes, I did. She had found some of my letters to the editor in the Boston newspapers through her friend O.O. Huggins, the one who really made her consider writing the book. And Rachel Carson contacted me. She wanted the sources of my information. I was very happy to supply them to her.
There were letters about DDT.
DDT and other of the sprays that were being used at the time. And I was involved with the group of 12 people on Long Island who had brought suit against the government for spraying of DDT, or the possibility of spraying DDT over the New England states against the gypsy moth. And it was a very seminal trial, and I was involved with them in getting out some of the information. So that and Rachel Carson was sort of part of the same piece. And when I found out that Rachel Carson was going to include in her work human experiences with the pesticides, then I was able to send her a lot of material that she was not aware of and put her in touch with some of the medical doctors who were working at this time exclusively on patients who were suffering from pesticide poisoning.
That book really made a huge difference. Do you feel like you played a part in that?
Well, a very small part, but certainly I do feel that I pushed it forward a little bit. And I was also involved with doctors who were environmentally concerned about the pesticide problem and other heavy metals in the environment and the chemicals that had come into many of the consumer goods. And they were seeing patients who were reacting to many of these substances.
With a lot of your early food writing and also your work with Rachel Carson, you were kind of ahead of the curve. You were at times considered a crank. Was it hard to always be ahead of the wave, or did you kind of get used to it after a while?
I think I got used to it after a while. I think the sad thing is to see all of the books that came after mine where people made much greater sales because there was more interest, but that's... I think that's one of the things when one is a pioneer that that happens.
Ever have the urge to say, I told you so?
I think it. I don't say it. I just probably have a smile on my face.
Beatrice Trum Hunter is on the front porch on NHPR. I'm John Walters. We'll be back after a short break. Still to come, Beatrice talks about being the daughter-in-law of Lotta Jacoby, the renowned photographer, how she takes pictures of ice crystals on her window panes, and the bat colony that lives in her barn. And tomorrow on the front porch, Marty on the Mountain, TV engineer and weatherman Martin Engstrom on his 38 years on top of Mount Washington.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. Support for The Front Porch comes from our contributing listeners like Jennifer Wilson of Putney, Vermont, and from Hall McGee Realtors in Portsmouth, a buyer broker that works solely for buyers. Information on the web at buyeragents4u.com, buyeragentsforyou.com. The Common Man family of restaurants, 10 convenient locations along I-93 from Windham to Lincoln, and on the web at theseaman.com. And Jamaica Cottage Shop, providers of plans, kits, or fully assembled custom-style storage sheds and rustic retreats, online at jamaicacottageshop.com.
This is The Front Porch on NHPR. I'm John Walters with Beatrice Trum Hunter, resident of Deering, New Hampshire. She's the author of at least 20 books on natural foods, healthy living, and the effects of chemicals and food additives. She's also a speaker and photographer. Her specialty is pictures of ice crystals. You were the daughter-in-law of the late photographer Lotta Jacoby. How did you meet her son, John Hunter?
I met him at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. I had had an appointment with a college chum to go to the museum and have lunch together, and she phoned me at the last minute. She said, there's a hitch. She said, my husband's out of town, and we have two dear friends who have come in, one from the Merchant Marines. This was, of course, during the Second World War. Merchant Marines, and the other one on furlough from the Army. Would you mind making it into a foursome? And I said, not at all. And so we met at the Museum of Modern Art, and my husband, John, was the very tired-looking fellow who was in on furlough from the Army.
So what was Lotta Jacoby like as a mother-in-law?
She was not a mother-in-law to me. We were good friends. Mm-hmm. She was not a mother-in-law in two basic senses. She was a very casual housekeeper, so I did not have to live up to any standards of housekeeping. And she had never cooked, so I didn't have to live up to those standards, which are two things that I think are very often part of a mother-in-law-daughter-in-law relationship. And we became very good friends. Also, Lotta and I were generally on one side of an argument, and John was on the other side. So he was up against these two strong women.
And two strong women with a lot of unconventional views and ways of living for the time.
Absolutely.
The 40s and 50s, especially.
Yes.
You've become a photographer in recent years. Was there any were you drawn into it by your relationship with Lotta Jacoby?
Not at all. I think, on the contrary, I was so intimidated by Lotta, this world-famous photographer, that I didn't even own a camera until she went into the nursing home. And at that point, I was scheduled to lecture for 9 weeks in Australia and New Zealand. And a photographer friend of mine said, you've got to get yourself a camera. And so she encouraged me. And when she found out that I was interested to take frost pictures on the window panes, she also advised me about what type of lens I should get. And when I came back from the trip, of course, and then I began to go into photography with the ice crystals. And I was only able to show Lotta any of the pictures that I took if they were black and white, because she did not like color. She would turn her head to the side and say, not for me.
Do you think she influenced you indirectly in your photographic work?
I think so. I think so, because her objective photography, the photogenics, which is abstract work, is very closely connected with the ice crystals, which are also abstracts. But I think growing up in New York City, I was exposed to many wonderful museums and art galleries, and I think long before I knew Lotta, I was interested in art.
How did you get interested in taking pictures of ice crystals?
Even as a small child, I remember having seen the frost on the windows, and I was always intrigued by them. And the house that I'm living in now, where I've been in Deering for nearly 50 years, has a long porch, which is unheated in the wintertime, and single panes of glass. So it is a gallery. And in cold weather, of course, I have all of these beautiful, beautiful ice crystals on the window, and they vary considerably.
You brought in a bunch of your photographs, and it really is a tremendous variation. You know, one picture to the next, they look completely different.
They do. And although the crystals themselves are colorless, the light coming in through the window does give them some coloring. And they're always amazing when I go, I jump out of bed in the morning and go out to see what's forming. I actually do that before I go to the bathroom. And I'm always quite startled to see the new formations I've never seen before.
Ice crystals are very delicate. Are they hard to capture on film?
They are. You have to get, I get about 11 inches from the pane of glass. And the lens has a very shallow range of focus, so it goes in or out very easily. And I can't use it. I cannot use a tripod because I can't get that close to the window with the tripod. The legs are in the way. So I have to hand hold the camera and remain quite still. And I try to take a deep breath and then hold it. And if I've been working on the porch for about a half hour, I come in and I feel I'm panting because I realize I've been holding my breath so many times.
Also kind of cold out there, I would think.
It is, but I dress warmly and I simply take off the gloves when I'm ready to snap the shots.
Beatrice Trum Hunter is on the front porch on NHPR. She's a writer and speaker on food issues. She's also a photographer, and she lives in Deering, New Hampshire. You've been helping with Lotta Jacoby's archives at the University of New Hampshire. What have you been doing?
I'm the last member of the family who is alive. And while I still have my clarity of thought, I am going to the archives every few weeks to fill in missing material and make corrections. And it's quite a tedious job. There are some 47,000 negatives, although fortunately I work with contact prints. But I'm slowly going through it, and Lotta is breathing down my neck, and she keeps saying, go, do it.
47,000 negatives.
Yes, and that's of course, only her collection of work once she came to the States, because she emigrated from Germany during the Hitler time.
Was she forced to leave Germany?
She wasn't forced, but I think she would have perished if she had stayed. So all of the glass plates and all of the material from Germany was really left and, has perished. Lotta was the fourth generation of photographers in her family. Her great-grandfather had gone to Paris to study with Louis Daguerre and brought back the patent for the daguerreotypes, and they lived in Posen at that time. And people used the name Jacoby to signify photography. They'd say, let's go to town and have a Jacoby taken. And so she was born into this family of photographers. And they had a very well-established atelier by the time they moved to Berlin. So all of that was lost.
And when she came to America, she had to pretty much start all over again.
Yes, she had quite a struggle. There was a small German emigre community in New York City, and that was helpful. But she did have a struggle.
Going through her archives at UNH, are you discovering things about her you didn't know?
Now and then there's something that is startling, but for the most part, I think I'm fairly well acquainted with her work, especially of the work, the body of work that took part after I entered the family.
Now, you met John Hunter, her son, in New York City during World War II, and after the war you lived in New York City for a while. When did you move to New Hampshire?
We moved up permanently in 1955. We had bought the place in Deering as a summer place for several years we were there. And at the end of the first summer, I had fallen in love with it so much that I made the announcement that I wanted to move there permanently, which shocked my husband because he was from big cities, Berlin and New York and so forth, London. And Lotta thought it was very reasonable. And so we began to fix the place over. We had no plumbing or electricity or anything. It was just a shell of a house, which would have been fine in the summers. And we spent 5 years in redoing it. And when we were ready to move up in 1955, Lotta announced, I'm moving up with you. Because her second husband had died, and the building in which she was living was coming down, and there was no way of her getting another apartment that would be comparable to the one that she had been in. So she simply moved up with us.
That must have been a big change for her.
It was a big change for all of us. Here were these three people whirling in different directions and in a fairly modest-sized building. And it was astonishing that we were still on speaking terms after several years of that.
You've been living on the same place in Deering for about 50 years now. What does that place mean to you?
A great deal. I feel that I will stay there, I hope, for the rest of my life. I intend keeling over the typewriter. But I have given more than 200 acres to the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests. There is a large beaver pond on the property, more than 25 acres. And that was the original point for preservation in my mind. And then as it went on, I thought I might as well give much more of the land. So I've just reserved a little bit of the land around the buildings and a little pond next to the house. So I think that that has been a good project.
I've been told that you have a bat colony in your barn.
Yes.
How many bats do you have?
Well, this is a lovely sentence at a cocktail party. I have about 750 bats in my barn. That's a rough estimate.
You have a university group that's been
studying these bats. Yes, it's Boston University, and it's a very serious study. It's been going on now for nearly 30 years. There's still a lot that's not known, basically, about the little brown bat. And so every year they have different projects. They one year they milked the bats. They took some of the milk because the bats are mammal, and mammal milk, the breast milk, is highly specific to the species. And so they took the milk back to the laboratory to analyze it. It's very high in fat because the bats have a need for a very high energy level, their metabolism. And bats have been so misunderstood and so maligned, and they're actually very interesting creatures.
Is there anything you haven't gotten around to doing yet? Any plans for the future?
I think so. I think I keep turning doors all of the time, or turning corners, or opening new doors. I'm not sure what it's going to be, but I'm still writing books, and I have been food editor of Consumers Research magazine for more than 20 years now. And unfortunately, the organization has just folded. So it is permitting me to have more time for other things, more time for writing books and other articles for other publications. But I'm open to new ideas, and it could be that I'm going to turn another corner in my life.
Well, I suppose just as important as eating well is keeping your mind active.
Absolutely. And also reaching out and doing things not necessarily for oneself, but for others. I think that that's also one of the key features in feeling that you're living a good life.
Well, Beatrice, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you, John.
Beatrice Trumhunter, writer, lecturer, food expert, and photographer, and resident of Deering, New Hampshire. The Front Porch is produced by Laura Colbert and Shay Zeller. You can get more information about today's show and listen anytime at our website, nhpr.org. You can also pass on your ideas for guests, order tapes or CDs of the show, and sign up for our weekly schedule by email. Next time on The Front Porch, Marty on the Mountain. For 38 years, Martin Engstrom worked on top of Mount Washington. He was an engineer for a TV station with a transmitter at the summit, and he did live weather reports on the local news. He was known for his thick Down East accent and his big, hearty smile. Marty is now retired, and he's written a memoir of his life on the mountain. I'm John Walters. Join me and Martin Engstrom on The Front Porch tomorrow at 6:30 on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, coming up to 7 o'clock and fresh air at the top of the hour. Stay with us. I'm Roger Parmley at NHPR. We get support from our contributing listeners and from Country Woods Unfinished Furniture, Route 27 in Raymond, a leader in unfinished furniture for over 20 years and a proud supporter of the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests. And from the Hopkinton Independent School, a country day school for preschool through 8th grade, now registering for the afternoon kindergarten enrichment program, 226-4662. This is New Hampshire Public Radio, WEBO Concord 89.1, WEBH Hanover 91.3, WEBN Keene at 90.7, WEBC Gorham 107.1, WEBJ Jackson 99.5. We're also heard in Nashua at 90.3, in Dover at 104.3, and in Littleton at 91.3 FM.